everybody. I'm Leslie. I'm
Hi, Leslie.
Let's see. I've known that guy that's going to tell his story for about 17 years. And he's a pretty neat guy. He helps me to be able to apply the traditions every day, because that's one thing we do in our relationship, is that we apply the traditions in our house. So our common welfare comes first. Our personal recovery depends on unity with this guy that I met at NABA about 17 years ago. And this summer will be 15 years that we've been married. And he's a really neat guy, so I'll let him get up here and tell you a little bit more of his story.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll be better this time.
I hope so. I love it. My name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
That she's correct. I was here in June and had a little incident. I've told my story many times. Many times, I speak publicly, and I got up here, and at about this moment, I started saying, things aren't right. Things aren't feeling right. I couldn't swallow, and I couldn't get thoughts together, and I felt like I was just going to, my heart was going to come out of my chest. So ambulance came. They took me to the hospital over here at St. Joe's, and after a weekend of all sorts of tests, they determined that maybe I had a panic attack mixed with not eating and a couple energy drinks and coffee. So my suggestion to anybody that would do any public speaking or anything that requires you to be of clear thought, eat during the day. Don't take any energy drinks. I haven't had one since. Drink moderate amount of coffee and learn to control your panic attacks, whatever that might be. So here I am tonight. If something happens, there's an RN. I'm good. I feel good there. I'm comfortable. And we know that it doesn't take very long for the EMTs to show up. One of the things that I want to do is, this is going to be I don't know, when I tell my story, I don't have a script. I usually bring my big book, but it's at the Serenity House. I forgot to pick it up tonight. Because I use that as a crutch. Because, for me, it is. It guides my life today, the book, the first 164 pages. So what I'm trying to do tonight is, if I can express something in my message, in my story, that somebody says, I'm that guy, or I can identify with him, and it helps you not take a drink for tonight and maybe get on this path, that's my whole objective. That's what I'm supposed to do. The 12 steps... At the very bottom of it, the 12th step is to be of service to my fellows. So I was told early on when I got sober that the thing that I needed to do the most, and most importantly, and do it every day, is not take a drink. And then if I can accomplish that, then I start living the life that this program outlines in the 12 steps, and there's principles behind that. So I'm going to try and share a little bit about what my story was like, what's happened, and what it's like now. There's one other thing that I always like to bring up that's in the big book, that it talks about. There's a part of the book that says the speakers are going to talk to you about some things of how they reestablish their relationship with God, something along that line. And I think that's what it's all about. Sobriety for me is not about quitting drinking, because if it was just quitting drinking, I'd booze it up, and then I'd say, I'm done. Go to detox, 28 days at Ridgeview, put the plug in the jug, and I could walk out of there and everything should be fine. How come it's not? How come it's not for an alcoholic like me? Because it's not about booze. I've been trying to fill that God hole for years with booze and other things to try and figure it all out, but I never could until I got into here. So that's kind of where I'm going to go. I think I was an alcoholic at a very, very early age, not necessarily drinking alcohol, but I had a lot of the isms. I remember I probably was 6 or 7 years old, kindergarten, maybe first grade, somewhere around there, and the tendency for me to be a big shot or to be very dramatic and make things far more worse than they were that was kind of the way my life was early on. And this one particular moment, I remember I did something that required my mother to physically abused me with a little swat on the fanny and maybe a little slap. I probably mouthed off to her or something. And I grew up in a generation where parents were allowed to do that and it was completely okay. And I don't hold my drinking. I don't blame my mom for that. That's not her fault that I became an alcoholic. But what happened was she slapped me. And I remember she sent me to my room and she said, when your father gets home, you know, we're going to deal with this. And I remember going up to my room and I remember that little tiny little red spot. And I took an emery board of hers and just kind of rubbed it and rubbed it and rubbed it. So I had this nice little shiner right here. And I'm thinking, I'll show mom. You know, dad will come home and he's going to see that. And she's in big trouble because you're not supposed to do that to your child. You can't. So I came home and I said, look what mom did to me. And he looked at me and he goes, yeah, you probably deserved it. And that was kind of the, you know, the reason I say that is that as an alcoholic, my the way I think is way different than most kids think or most adults think. Is I was thinking, okay, I'm gonna one up you. I'm gonna try and make it worse than it is, or I'm gonna try and make it better than it is, when it should be just the way it is. We should just be like tonight. I need to be in the moment, and it's hard to do for me. I want to, you know, driving over here. I'm thinking I gotta tell, you know, the perfect story. You know, you got to share what's, you know, make sure you stay in the 12 steps, the 12 traditions. God forbid you mention any outside issues and all of these things that we're ingrained with to do. And then when I leave tonight, I'm going to go home with Leslie and say, damn, I should have said this. I should have done that. But right now, in this very moment, I'm going to tell the story that's coming out. I don't know what that's going to be, but it is. So that's kind of a little, you know, I grew up, I think, early on having a lot of alcoholic tendencies. I grew up in a great family. I grew up in Ohio. I was born in Cleveland and grew up just outside of Columbus in a town called Dublin. And went to grade school there and had a great childhood. My parents, we weren't well off, but we were not poor. My dad worked and my mom raised three. I had two older brothers. And so I can't blame anything in my childhood. I went to a Catholic grade school. I ended up going to a Catholic high school. And I ended up going to a Catholic Jesuit college. So religion for me and the Catholicism, I'm not a recovering Catholic. I just don't practice it anymore. But I have no issues with anything. I grew up with a God that was fairly loving. And I believe that was a great gift given to me because when I desperately needed God again in my life, I went to the God of my childhood. I went to the God that I remember when I was doing my first communion, when I was an altar boy. The God that was I was taught was a good dude, a loving God, forgiving God. I was never raised in the family that if you do this, you know, you're going to hell. It was never that way. And I feel sorry for those that did because I think that's a huge issue. Because when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't have an issue with God. I really didn't. I mean, I knew that he existed. I just had an issue with relying on him. Really? I don't know about that. Now, that was kind of a struggle for me a little bit. Because, see, I had done so well in my life that brought me in here. I don't know if I needed this power greater than myself. So growing up, I had a really good family, but in high school, we moved down here. It was the summer of my eighth grade year, and we moved down to Atlanta. My dad got a job, and it was exciting. You know, it was my parents were excited to get away from the weather in Ohio and coming down to Atlanta. And Atlanta at that time, 85 was just two lanes going through Atlanta. You know, well, four, one going one way and one going the other, but it was a small town, and it boomed while I was here, so it was a great place. I loved it. So, and I went to the school here. I went to St. Pius. And I'll tell you, you know, I spoke a little earlier about the being a little kid and being a, but, you know, one of the things that I started noticing, and I remember I started having a little anxiety issues, you know, like I had the other time I was here. I remember being very, very nervous and scared about going to a new school. And in eighth grade, and we were staying at I grew up in Tucker, and we were, the house that we were moving into wasn't quite ready. It was being painted or something, and So we ended up staying at the Hilton Inn on La Vista. It used to, I don't know what it is now, but it used to be a Hilton. And, you know, that was kind of cool. You know, we were living there for a week and swimming pool and eating at the restaurant and all that. But when it was time to go to school, I kind of all of a sudden started feigning being sick. And I didn't want to go. And my mom's like, what's up with you? And I would cry and I'd say, you don't understand. I don't want this is. I'm scared. I don't want to go. And there's you can't make me go. And again, I mean, I just remembered this just, you know, probably the last time I told my story, that this part of my story I never remembered until it just came up. That it was another, it was fear. I was in eighth grade, going to ninth grade, I was still fearful and didn't know what it was all about. I couldn't figure it out. But I eventually got to school and made friends because that's what I do. You know, I eventually get over that and move on and made fast friends. Had a lot of friends there. So about junior year, we were all going to a high school basketball game. And about four of us gathered around, no, maybe it was five of us, gathered around behind the little convenience store, St. Pius, if anybody's familiar where it is. It's on Johnson Road in Shalaford, and there's a convenience store there. It used to be a Texaco or something. It might still be. And somebody went in and was and bought an 8-pack of the little Miller ponies. Remember? Does anybody remember those? It's little 7-ounce beers. So five of us split 8 of these ponies. I drank, there was like one left or something, and I drank that. And I didn't get this like, I have arrived. Like so many of us get, you know, that feeling of euphoria that this is the ticket. I've now become somebody. I didn't get that. I just felt like I'm part of. I'm part of a group. We drank some beer. We're going to go to the basketball game, and we're going to have a little, you know, beer on our breath and talk to girls, and we'll be cool, that kind of stuff. And that's kind of where it began for me. And high school was that way. I didn't have any issues with alcohol in high school. We'd go to parties. I mean, it was just part of it. Every weekend, we'd go somewhere. You'd go, you know, to a park or somebody's house, and there'd be beer, and you just drink beer. And I never got totally wasted, but I got buzzed and all of that. But the summer of my senior year, before I went off to college, I had an opportunity to visit schools. And I ended up choosing a school in New Orleans because the very thing that they did for us to kind of entice us to go there, they took us to Bourbon Street, you know, and I got rip-roaring drunk. And I remember coming home thinking, told my dad, hey, Dad, I've decided to go to Loyola. He's like, great choice, son, a liberal arts Jesuit school. You get a fine education. My intentions were not that at all. There were things that I said, oh, it's a good school. I was going to be a doctor. I had a good pre-med program. But my intention was that you could drink there at 18, and I was 18 at the time. So that summer, when I came back, my drinking kind of escalated. I don't know why. I have no clue. It just did. And there was a couple times that I drank and woke up on like a lawn chair at a pool at somebody's house where we had a party, and I, you know, had no clue where I was, how I got there. So when I got to college, it really escalated. I was, you know, the very first night that I got there, my parents, you know, we went through the whole orientation, and then they drop you off to the dorm. I, you know, one of my buddies from high school went to school with me, so we were roommates. And they said, good luck. You know, you're on your own. And soon as, I mean, they couldn't probably weren't even out of Loyola's parking lot that we were on the trolley going down to Bourbon Street. And I came home that night, and I passed out completely. And they had, you know, they got pictures of it, of me. There's, you know, people writing on me, shaving cream. All of that. Don't remember any of it. And that was my, for the next 4 years, that was the way I drank. In it, you know, never any major problems. I drank a lot. I, you know, started out as a pre-med major. I ended up with a history degree. Because it's far easier to drink and read books than it is to drink and try and study to become a doctor. That was my thinking. You know, it was alcoholic, you know, the easier, softer way, in a way. So that was it. So I, you know, I was always, I had a girlfriend while I was there. I met a girl, and we dated while we were there, and we had just a blast in college. And I ended up, she graduated a year before me, and she moved to Atlanta, and then I graduated. I did actually graduate, which is amazing. I have a history degree and a biology minor. means nothing. I'm in it today. I'm in an engineering field, so go figure. So I ended up. We ended up coming back here, and the next thing for me to do is, I was kind of always miserable, and never. It was never a good relationship to begin with. I was never real faithful to her, because when you're drinking alcohol, sometimes your inhibitions go down, and you know, other things look better, and. You know, that was kind of the way I was. I wasn't a good person to be with when I was drinking. I was fun. I didn't have any violent tendencies, but I was not a monogamous man to a woman that I was in a relationship with. And there were lots of times that there were things that, as a result of that, I got into, you know, there were a lot of trouble, a lot of issues in relationships. And one of the things that I knew that I probably should not marry this woman, but because I'm a fear-based guy and I had a hard time saying no to anybody, and I don't want to be guilted into anything, because I just, you know, we got out of college, she graduated, the next thing I know, I'm moving here and we get married because it's the next thing. She wants to have kids, and I remember my mother saying, "Terry, please don't marry this woman. It'll be the end of you." And I didn't know what to do. I really did know that I should not do this. It wouldn't be fair to her, and it just wasn't the right thing to do. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know how to say I'm done. I don't want to do this. I need to figure out what's going on in my life. I had no clue how to do that. So we got married. You know, a drunk marries a woman that's, you know, a drunk in college, but she gets married and grows up. I didn't. So I got a position with an insurance company, and had a pretty good, you know, nice little career starting out. And our first daughter was born in 1989. And my drinking was, at that point, was always going out with the guys, happy hours afterwards, just for a few. Most of the time I would come home 8, 9 o'clock, pretty much into the wind. And at that point, my soon-to-be ex-wife was beginning to say, you know, you drink a lot. You got a problem. You know, there's things that you need to do to quit. And I just didn't see it. I said, you know, I think the problem's you. I think the problem's your mother. And I think the problem is work that I'm at. So we made this brilliant decision to move from Atlanta to St. Louis. That maybe that'll fix everything, because her family was from St. Louis, and if anybody's ever been to St. Louis or knows any gal that's from St. Louis, they're like homing pigeons. They want to go home, and they stay there, and they want to be close to family, and there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's, you know, St. Louis is a great town. We really enjoyed it, but we moved there for the wrong reasons. It wasn't simply because it was the right thing to do. She was miserable with me here because she didn't know anybody. She didn't like my family, and I was a drunk, and she thought if she could get home with her family, things might get a little bit better, and it didn't. It got far worse very quickly. When we went up there, my drinking escalated. My second daughter was born up there, and, you know, that was the other thing. I mean, here I am. I'm this, like, Peter Pan. I was a 25-year-old, 26-year-old kid. And, you know, I had a job, and I had two little daughters to raise, and I was still acting as though I was 18 years old down in Bourbon Street. I mean, I still did all of those crazy things. Except the problem was, at this point, outside issues came into my life. And those outside issues, I will say this, I believe that it was a godsend now. It was a blessing, because they brought me to my knees far quicker than I think alcohol would have ever done. And with those outside issues came, there were things that you needed to do. I had to spend a lot more money for that stuff, a lot more. And I wasn't making that much money to do that. So I came up with creative ways to make more money, and it wasn't legal that I did. A lot of it was what you would call, a lot of people might call, I stole it, which is what I did. I came up with some ideas to support my habit, and those ideas eventually caught up with me to where By this time, my wife and I had separated. My oldest daughter's, was it her sixth birth, 1994, she was born in 89, her sixth birthday, I told my father-in-law and my wife that I'm leaving, I'm done, I'm out of here. And I hooked up with a guy that he and I did a lot together, and I lived with him, and I thought, finally, the bachelor life, everything's gonna be fine. But it wasn't. It just got worse. It got worse very, very quickly. But I didn't see it because I didn't have any major consequences at this point. They were coming. Believe me, they were coming. But they hadn't been there yet. And I wasn't thinking about those things because as this alcoholic, I'm like, damn the consequences right now. I know it's wrong. I know it's wrong to be setting up these bogus business claims and writing insurance checks and buying all this outside issues and doing all, I knew it was wrong. I knew it. I didn't care. I just didn't. I was like, you know, what's going to happen to me? I'll get a lawyer and everything will be fine. They'll slap me on the wrist, pay it back. It'll all be good. That's stupid thinking. It's not what happens. Not when you do what I did. It just doesn't happen that way. And a few years down the road in 1996, I was so addicted and so alcoholically strung out that I could not keep track of everything that I was doing. I couldn't do it. And people that I were hanging out with were bad folks. Bad folks. And what happened was, is I was working for an insurance company then, and what they did is they allowed us to, I could go to a house, and if you had a fire that burned it out, we'd go in there and adjust it and figure out this is what it's going to cost to fix it and write a check to the insured, and I had like a $35,000 check writing limit. Give him a check. Well, we came up with this brilliant idea to get some of these other folks that we were writing claims for. We'll write these checks to you. I'll write you a check for $5,000, but I'm going to write it for $7,500, and you're going to give us $1,500 of it. Worked for a while. It's a great thing. So we were using that to fund our outside issues. And it worked for about 9 months. August of 1996, the company that I was working for was out of Cincinnati, Ohio. They came down and they said, look, we've got a problem. And they had a, you know, box, and they had a stack of a folder about that big. We got some concerns with these claims, you know, that we need you to help us out with. What happens was, and this is because of alcohol and drugs, I'm not thinking that, you know, when you write a check from an insurance company, you give it to the insured, well, the insurance company sends out a notice that says, hey, how is your claim? We see that you were paid this amount of money. Did everything go right? Do you think it was fair? And people were going, I didn't get paid that. I got paid this. And they're like, So it's, you know, the red flags kick up. They do an audit. And they found out that, oh my God, this guy's writing checks all over the place to these bogus companies, bogus insureds. So they came in and they said, you know, we got a problem with that. And I was really, really at this point at the bottom. I didn't know it yet, but I was at the bottom. And when they came in, I said, I can't explain it. And they're like, why not? And I said, because I have a lot of personal issues. And if you would have seen me then, you'd say, yeah, no doubt. I was living in this basement apartment. I'd been divorced from my ex-wife. I was living in this basement apartment, hanging out with what I would consider the dregs of society. They were my friends. Long, you know, buddies to the end, friends, you know. These guys would soon as kill you. As long as you had dope, they were your friends. Those kind of guys. And I said I had personal problems. They go, yeah, well, we kind of figured that. We're going to need all your claims. We're going to need the keys to the company car. And you're no longer employed with the company. And I'm like, that. I was thinking, that's it? Okay. That's easy enough. Do that? So I'm unemployed. Whoopee. I can get another job. Go right upstairs. Start it all over again. And for the next 6 months, I really didn't work. I was in and out. I was doing all sorts of odd jobs, selling. I was selling pagers, and that was a good thing to sell when you're in the drug business. Selling pagers and, you know, all sorts of, you know, phone service. And just, I never could hold a job because it was the only thing I wanted to do was to party. And and my life was a wreck, and I was a whore. I wasn't paying child support, and I was barely seeing my kids, and my ex-wife was just, she just was hoping that I would go away forever. And what happened was is that May 30th of 1997 was my last drink. And what happened that day was I had gone to, had been out for a weekend, and had gone to a bank to cash a check that I'd stolen from one of the guys that I was living with. I took one of his checks and went to the bank to cash it. And when I went to the bank, this wasn't that day. It was 2 days before that. I went to the bank and gave it to the teller, and she kind of looked at me, and I'm sure I was just, looking as good as I look tonight. And she said, "Let me do something, Mr. Dunn. I just need to verify the signature on this." I was like, "Sure, no problem." And as soon as she went in the back, I went like this. Right out that door. I left my driver's license. Bad idea. If you're going to commit a crime, keep as much of the evidence out. So that night, I had found out that there was a warrant out for my arrest for trying to cash a $300 check fraudulently. What had happened was they called the guy I was living with, and he's like, I never wrote that check out to him. And then he started going through all the other checks that I'd stolen from him. So long story short, I was in a lot of trouble, and it just had come to a head. For years, the way I was living had come to a head on just this one incident. But what's funny is that about 2 years before this happened, I remember sitting in a church and asking God to help me. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what I need to do, but I need help. I don't know why I'm miserable. I don't know why I want peace in my life. And I left there and went to a bar. But I went to that church, and I really believe to this day that God answered my prayer that day. Because what happened was, is that when I got, when May 30th, 1997 showed up, I had heard rumor that there was a warrant for my arrest, that my ex-wife was going to make sure that I never saw my kids again, ever, and that there was nobody around anymore that I could hang with. Nobody. So I got this brilliant idea. If I go to a treatment center, somebody told me out there when I was using, I could check in. And when I checked in, they can't arrest you because you're in this safe environment. Can't go out. He's a sick man. Can't go out. And so I'm thinking, that's what I'll do. So there was some warm bush beer in the floorboard of my 1987 Toyota Corolla. And I knew they wouldn't take me in for just going out on coke. They just wouldn't do it. Because with alcohol, you could, go to DTs and all. So I drank that bush beer down and went in, and I went to the lady and I said, "I think I got a problem. I need help." She's like, "Yeah, I think you probably do." And she says, "Do you have insurance?" And I said, "I don't know." And I hadn't been to work. This time I was working for a company, a long-distance company, selling for them. And I hadn't been to work in weeks. Sure enough, I pull out my wallet, and there's an insurance card, and it was still good. Amazing. They're like, "Well, come on in, You got insurance? Come on in. We can help you out." And that night, I made a call to my ex-wife, and she said, "Oh, yeah, you're in so much trouble, Terry. Let me tell you something. I talked to your parents. They don't ever want to talk. They think nobody wants anything to do with you. You're never going to see your kids again. In fact, everybody wishes you maybe just go away, maybe just go ahead and die." And I kind of figured that was going to happen. I hadn't talked to my parents in a couple of years, and maybe not that long, maybe about a year, year and a half. And what had happened was, is that night, I checked in, and I'm walking down the corridor. They had given me Librium and all sorts of stuff, and I was feeling pretty good, and I was beginning to think, if I get in here a couple days rest, I'll be able to figure it all out. It'll all be fine. Just clean up a little bit, get this stuff out of you, and think, Terry, think. And as I'm walking down this hallway, they had payphones on both sides that when a parent or somebody called in, they'd ring it up to the patient's floor. And they did that. Evidently somebody had called, and as I was walking by that phone, it rang. It's one of the God miracles to me. It rang, and I picked up the phone, and I said, "Hello?" And it was my dad. He's like, "Terry?" I'm like, "Dad? I haven't talked to him in forever." And it's a big deal to me. And I finally got honest with him. I said, Dad, I'm in big trouble. He goes, I know. I know you are. Michelle's called us. Your mom and I are on our way up. It's going to be okay. That was the very first time in a long time that I just felt, you know, when you finally let it go, you finally tell the truth, that you've been holding on to some deep, dark secret, and you finally dump it, how you feel, there's a sense of relief. And that's the way I felt that night, that Mom and Dad are coming. Mom and Dad are coming. Everything's going to be okay. And the next morning, they got there. They drove all night from Atlanta to St. Louis. And I went down, you know, I met him, and we had lunch or whatever, and I kind of gave him a not quite 100% truth of what was going on, just that I had done a couple dumb things, but I think it'll all work out. And when I went to check out, we were going to go to Atlanta. Remember I said they can't arrest you in a treatment center, but they can when you check out. Because when I was checking out, the security guards came behind me and said, Mr. Dunn, St. Louis County Police are here to see you. So my mom got to see me put into a police car, and I was taken down to St. Louis County. And, you know, because of the business I was in, the stuff I was doing, I always had to have attorneys because, you know, you need those people when you're doing what I was doing. And one of my best friends in college was an attorney, and the only time I ever called him was when I was in trouble, and he knew it. The only time I ever called him. So I told my dad, call Tim. So he calls Tim, and he's like, hey, Mr. Dunn, how are you doing? And he, well, Tim, letting you know, Terry's in jail. And he's like, oh, great. That doesn't surprise me. And he said, I can't help him. I'm a corporate attorney, but I know somebody who's a criminal attorney. So he passed this guy on, and by this time, I had gone down to jail, and I got honest with the cop, the detective that was investigating this. At this point, it was just this one check. And he said, look, he goes, you know, I'm not going to do anything. You know, you got a little issue here and all that. And I said, well, there's way more than that. And I dumped it all on what I had done. And this whole incident with the insurance company, this still hadn't come up. That whole thing that I'd done with the insurance company was nothing had ever come up with that. So I thought I was free and clear of that. What I was dealing with were these checks that I had written from this guy's account. And he said, yeah, you know, these things, you need some help. And my dad came in, and, you know, they talked to some people. And the attorney that Tim came in and comes in, he said, so what have you told him? I said, I told him everything. He's like, oh, my God, are you kidding me? He goes, you never tell him that. You don't say any more. I'm your attorney. I said, you want to know something, Bob? I just am sick and effing tired of lying. I'm just tired of it. I don't care anymore. I don't care what the consequences are. I'm done. I'm just so tired. And that was the beginning of recovery for me. I was finally sick and tired of doing the shit I was doing, that I wanted just to have some peace. Did I know I was going to come to AA and know that I was going to be transformed into something totally different, that tonight from the guy I was? No. I just knew that I just wanted some peace, and I was willing to pay the consequences at that very moment. But as the consequences built up, because that detective, once he got into it, discovered that there was way more than just this little bitty, maybe possibly close to a felony, you know, maybe misdemeanor check. I ended up having, at that point, I was charged with 10 counts of interstate theft, forgery, and something else, because the checks that I took from this dude were written on a check, but the thing is, the bank was out of state, so it became federal. And then since stuff was mailed, and I made sure I manipulated addresses so he wouldn't see it, it became like even more federal, because it had something to do with the mail. I was looking at a ton of time, a ton. It was not good. But what happened was, is that for whatever reason, the detective, my father, the attorney, and the judge all said, look, your son's 33 years old. We don't think he's a true criminal. We think he's got a drug and alcohol problem. And if you're willing to take him and make sure he makes his court dates and all of that, we'll let him go back to Atlanta with you. And that's what happened. So I got a little reprieve. So I was able to come back to Atlanta. And when I got down here, it was probably, I don't know, the second week in June. that my parents were like, you need to find a place to go, treatment center. You have to. And I'm like, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. I think I just go to a couple AA meetings. And oh, speaking of which, AA meetings. I remember going to my very first AA meeting that I went to when I got, it was, I had, my dad said, you're going to an AA meeting when we got back to Atlanta. So they dropped me off at Toco Hills, and not the Toco Hills now that meets on off of Claremont, but it used to be over off Druid Hills and Toco Hills, I think. Presbyterian Church right there at the corner. And I remember going in there that night, and they dropped me, and my dad dropped me off and said, I'll be back in an hour and a half and get you. I go into that meeting, and people are like, is there any visitors here? And I'm like, yes, my name's Terry. I'm an alcoholic, business from St. Louis. I got 10 years. I'm just glad to be here. And, you know, I was just like this lying sack of shit. And I know that these old timers that I eventually got to meet at the real meetings probably knew, oh boy, here we go. This guy here is looking, you know, he's about this big around, his eyeballs are sunken, you know, and he's trying to say he's 10 years sober. Oh, really? Share some of your experience with us. You know, well, let me tell you about the 12 step, gentlemen. You know, I don't even remember what I said, but I lied about that because I didn't want to admit that I wasn't as sober as I should be. I wanted to be a big shot before I was even in the program. I mean, it was crazy. So what happened was my parents were like, you got to get into a treatment center. And if you don't, we're going to put you on a bus, give you a one-way ticket, send you back to St. Louis, and you're on your own. We're done with you. So I decided, okay, what am I going to do? So we're in Tucker, and I'm like, oh, Doraville, that's close. Call this place called Mar. Anybody ever heard of it?
Yeah.
It saved my life. I didn't want to go there. I called the guy, and I'm on the phone with Doug Brush, who was at that time the CEO of it, and he was running the men's program, and he said, so, Terry, tell me a little bit about your story. And I was talking. I couldn't have been talking more than 10 minutes. He said, let me ask you a question. Why are you so angry? I'm like, what? It's like, why are you so angry? I can hear it in your voice. Well, you'd be angry, too. I got felony charges coming up there. I got child support I haven't been paid for. I got to get a job. I got to get my life fixed. It's like, yeah, why don't you come over and visit with us? Come over today and talk to us, and let's do an evaluation. And as soon as I hung up the phone, I think he called my parents afterwards because... And they arranged the plan, you know. So I get over there, and we go into his office, and we're talking, and pretty soon he's like, I think you'll stay. And I'm like, I'm not staying here. He's like, here's the deal, Terry. It's a 90-day program that we're requiring you to come to. And your parents are willing to put down a deposit, but you're going to have to figure out a way to pay for the rest of it. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And I cussed my mom and dad out and told them that they didn't know what the hell they were doing. And Doug said, Mr. and Mrs. Dunn, why don't you just leave right now? This has all been arranged. I didn't know it. They just said, why don't you just step out and let me talk to Terry on my own? Well, when they stepped out, they went outside, got my luggage, stuck it in the front foyer, and they were gone because they had already made the arrangements. He's not going anywhere. He's here. And that was the beginning. And that's where I learned to pray. So my life, I would say, it was very, very unmanageable. When I walked into these rooms, it was very unmanageable. But I didn't know it was unmanageable. I just thought I had a whole bad luck, you know, bad run of luck, bad luck. But what happened was when I got into Mar, I began to learn a little bit about what AA was about. That, you know, the unmanageability part, I could get pretty quickly. I think most of us, at least for me, when I walked into these rooms and I walked into Mar, when somebody said, do you think you got a drinking and drugging problem? Yeah. I do. I think I do. I think I was finally licked. I think I knew then. I knew for a long time. But I finally said, you know, I admitted it. You know, it says in the book that we have to admit to our innermost selves that we're an alcoholic. And when I can do that, that's the honesty part. When I can finally admit that I'm an alcoholic and know it and be okay with it, I'm on my way to recovery. Because it's no longer a stigma to me. It's okay. I've got a problem with booze. It's okay. I have a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession. And that's what I was taught, was that you're not a bad dude. You just got wrapped up in a lot of stuff. Yes, stealing and all of the things that you did, is that character defects? Oh, yeah. I mean, you got some issues with that. But we can work through that. We can help you figure out a way to live life without having to steal, in a sense. And that's kind of the beginning for me. Somebody said, do you believe that you're an alcoholic? Do you believe that when you drink, your life has really bad consequences? Yes. Do you believe that your life is unmanageable? I don't know. Okay, well, let's lay it out. You know, you're looking at 60 years in a federal penitentiary. You're looking at, You know, restitution in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $40,000. You haven't paid child support in a year and a half. Your life, you got divorced because you're drinking. Your whole life is all about drinking. You blame everybody for your drinking. All of these things. Do you think your life is unmanageable? Maybe in this area, not, you know, but maybe. Okay, I'll give you that. Okay, good. Are you willing to believe that we might have a solution for you? That there might be something out there that can help you get sober and live a life better than you've ever imagined? Yeah, maybe. Are you willing to believe in God? I believe in God. I trust God. They're like, do you have a problem with God? No, not really. Okay, then you're well on your way. And they, you know, I basically did the first three steps right away and had no clue. So what they asked me to do is they said, there's a couple things we want you to do in, while you're living here. We want you to be accountable to a community of men, not women, of men. And they said, we're going to put you in a group, and you're going to live as a community, and you guys are going to do everything together. You're going to go to classes together. You're going to cook together. You're going to go to meetings together. You're going to have community meetings together. You're going to talk to each other. You're going to learn to be honest with a man. Are you okay with that? Like, do I have a choice? No, you don't, if you want to stay here. So I learned what we should all learn when we're kids, to be open with people of my own gender, to learn to have friends and be honest with them about everything and be willing to have people call me out on my stuff. It's funny when you're in a halfway house, you know, you got the senior member. He's got like 90 days and he's like the guru and he's telling you, you ain't sober. You're not doing any of this right. You got to be doing, and you look to that guy, it's like, oh, he's right. I'm not. I got to be doing better. There was a young kid that was my roommate, Aaron, and he was kind of a pompous ass. But what Aaron taught me was that he taught me how to pray. And the reason he did it is that he was getting down on his knees every morning by the bed. We had these twin beds. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm praying. Well, this is how you're supposed to pray in AA. I'm like, what? He said, I haven't gotten down on my knees since I was like an altar boy. He's like, it's what we're supposed to do. And, you know, I'm doing the third step prayer. I didn't know what that was. So he taught me, you know, how to pray. And that was the beginning for me of really beginning to establish a relationship with God. Because it was very awkward, very, very awkward early on to do that. But, it, you know, the thing is that sobriety, what I've learned today, is that I had to learn to be really, really, really comfortable at being uncomfortable, if that makes sense. Because it's all about change. Everything that I did early on, even to this day, the things that are most uncomfortable for me are usually the things that I need to do, because it's something that goes against the grain of the way I think. So when I learned to pray to do those things, then I learned that, okay, these are the rules that you need to do. You need to get a sponsor, no he-ing and she-ing. He-ing and she-ing, what's that about? You can't have a girlfriend while you're here. No girls. Establish a relationship with men. You need to look at all the women in recovery as your sisters. All of them. They come in with more mental baggage and more emotional baggage than you can ever imagine. Leave them alone. I'm a great proponent of that today. If you're a newcomer and you're looking for a date in AA, leave the women alone until they get some time. For heaven's sakes, leave them alone. Same with the women. Leave the men alone. Because what happens in a relationship is I get focused on the relationship and I forget about recovery. And when I forget about recovery, I'm a great forgetter. I'm going to forget about, well, what's the point of me not taking a drink? It seems to be reasonable. I might as well do it because I've forgotten why I'm here. So what happens was is I got involved in he-ing and she-ing because I'm not an alcoholic that follows rules. I'm not a guy that takes direction very well, especially early on. And I met a girl, and we justified it. We went to meetings together. We were going to all that stuff. We weren't drinking. But I got kicked out of that program because of that. And they told me, they said, Terry, if you can't follow the little rules of a halfway house, you're never going to follow the big rules of life. And that stuck to me. I mean, that really, it makes no sense, but it stuck. Because it's like, you're right. If you can't, we ask you to do these simple little things, how are you ever going to do the big things in life that are required when you're out there? So that's what the book tells me too. It says you got to do certain things, that I've got to maintain a spiritual connection with God for a daily reprieve. that I've got to do certain things if I want to have this happy, joyous, and free life. It's those little things early on that taught me that stuff. So I get kicked out, and as a result of that, I got consequences, which we forget that there's any. I can do anything I want in sobriety as long as I'm willing to pay the consequences. I can do anything I want. Well, I got kicked out, and guess what? Part of my court stuff was I had to stay in a halfway house. So I had made it back in front of the court dates, and I was getting probably, I don't know, I had about 9 months sober when I finally went up there for my final deal. And the deal was my attorney said, the judge and the DA have come to an agreement, you're going to do 5 years. That's the best deal they're going to give you. And so just get a one-way ticket. And I did. And we went up there, and I went in front of the judge, and she was a prosecutor's judge. And she said, I've read over everything. Mr. Dunson's, in recovery and doing all the right things. He's working and all that stuff. But I'm not going to take the DA's recommendation. And I thought, oh, God. And my attorney said, oh, God, oh, no. I'm going to do all of it. And she's like, I don't know what it is, but there's something that I think this guy can be somebody, that he's not what who he was when he came here. So I'm going to give him, you're going to do some time, you're not going to do five. So I ended up doing like 30 days, and I had 5 years probation on that, and I had to pay all this restitution. And what happened was that 5 years later, I went up to that same judge after I'd done the restitution, because the program tells me I'm supposed to do it. I cleaned up all of my shit, my financial shit. But that insurance stuff, guess what? I showed up. 5 years I'm going back and forth to St. Louis, back and forth, in and out of jails, in and out of courtrooms. Not a thing comes up. My wife and I, we were married at this point, she gets a phone call. We had a newcomer in our house and some jewelry got stolen. She calls the police and says, I want to report it. The detective calls this girl that we suspect did it. And the girl's like, you need to look into her husband. He's a crack addict. He's probably the one that took it. Well, she did. And I had an active warrant from IRS that had come up in 1999, 2 years after I'd gotten sober, that for whatever reason, it never happened. But God knew now it's time. You can deal with it. So I called up Bob, who was no longer a criminal attorney, who put me in touch with somebody else. And he said, I suggest you get your ass up here, because if they pick you up, it'll be weeks before you show up here. You'll go from town to town to town to town in a freaking paddy wagon. So he made arrangements with a bail bondsman. I went up there and I turned myself in, 5 years sober, and said, I'm here to turn myself in on a warrant. And two detectives came down and said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I'm here to turn myself in on a warrant. They said, yeah, but this warrant's like 5 years old. Why are you doing it? I said, because I'm in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and my sponsor told me I needed to. So I'm here. And they're like, holy shit. So they grabbed me and I went and I got booked and I got out. And I had consequences again. I got another 5 years probation. I had to pay all that restitution. So at 10 years sober, I finally got all of my financial amends behind me. 10 years. I was on probation for 10 years. All because of what this program told me to do. I never liked any of it. I wasn't doing it cheerfully. I was not all happy, joyous, and free having to do all that stuff. I did it begrudgingly, but I did it. Because, again, AA for me is all about action. It's about the things that we are supposed to do that we don't want to do. It's always about doing stuff that's very, very uncomfortable but is required in order for me to have a happy, joyous, and free life. Now, keep in mind, those 10 years, I've had a lot going on. I met my wife in the program. She came in one day and said, I need help. And I looked at a buddy of mine and said, she might be fun on a date. And a year later, we went on a date. And we've been dating ever since. It's pretty awesome. It's a pretty cool thing. I've been a good employee. Today, I'm now an employer. I've had my own business now for 3 years. In the business that I started out at that I was told to do because I was not allowed to get back into the selling, I had to go work a $7 an hour job. And I started out pulling wire. And now I own a company that employs guys that do the same thing that I started out doing. Whether that's a result of AA or not, I don't know, but I think it is. I work with a lot of guys. I know I've rambled. I work with a lot of guys. I do step work. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. I do a big book study up in Buford, Serenity House, at 6:30. We say it's not a real AA meeting. It's a book study because we kind of do it along the lines of Joe and Charlie. So if you do come up there and you're supposed to go to 5 meetings a week and you try and count that one, it's not. But I do the things that I'm supposed to do. When somebody asks me to speak, and if I can do it and I don't fall out dead and have the ambulance show up, I do it. I don't know what... All I can tell you is that if you're brand new here, I'll finish with this, because I kind of rambled. I mean, without my crutch, I don't have direction, but I think everybody's gotten the message that if you get sober, there's a lot of good that can happen. But as a result of whatever you've done that brought you here, there's consequences. And you got to be willing to sit through that shit. And you got to be willing to get through it. And I can assure you, if you're willing to do that, and you're willing to do a bunch of stuff that you don't want to do, but you need to do, and you just put half the effort into it that you did to buy booze or do whatever it is that you do, your life will be better than ever imagined. Because from a guy that in 1997 that was figuring out a way to avoid a warrant with warm Busch beer, of all things, Busch beer, walking into a treatment center to standing up here today with a fantastic relationship with my kids, those kids that I was never ever going to see again, call me today and we talk all the time. Not about just, you know, kids. My kids talk to me about, they're adults now, what's going on with them, issues in their life, knowing they said, we know what you've been through, we need help. I mean, that's amazing. I don't know where that comes from, and I'm not patting myself on the back because I was not a good father. This is all a result of AA, is that I was able to reestablish that relationship. I have a cordial relationship with my ex-wife. It's not great. We've been divorced forever, and she still hates me, but that's okay. Somebody told me she probably hates me because now I'm the guy that she was supposed to have married. And it's probably a good point. You know, but AA is a great way to live. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're questioning whether you've got a drinking problem or not, you know, question it all you want. But if you really, really want your life to be better than you ever can imagine, try this thing. You know, give it 6 months. Give it a year. See what happens in your life. I challenge all the guys that I sponsor to write down a list of what you want, the most you want in the first year of sobriety. Put it on that list, fold it up, put it in an envelope, stick it in your drawer. And after the next year, if you're still here, open it up and see what has transpired. You'd be amazed of the things that happen. And there's a lot of bad that happens too in AA. A lot of bad goes on. But you want to know something? I've had a lot of that happen, and not once have I ever considered taking a drink. And that, the bottom line is that. If I don't take a drink today, what do they say? We're winners. But if I don't take a drink during the good times and the bad times, and I live my life to the principles as best I can, I'm not perfect. Some days I don't want to be Jesus. But there are really, really good days and really, really bad days. And not to want to take a drink, that's a damn miracle. Thank you.